Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Receiving this message.
We are Ken Jennings and John Roderick. We speak to you from our present, which we can only assume is your distant past, the turbulent time that was the early 21st century.
Fearing the great cataclysm that will surely befall our civilization, we began this monumental reference of strange and obscure human knowledge. These recordings represent our attempt to compile and preserve wonders and esoterica that would otherwise be lost.
So whether you're listening from an advanced civilization or have just reinvented the technology to decrypt our transmissions, this is our legacy to you.
This is our time capsule. This is the Omnibus.
You have accessed entry 928.IS0117, certificate number 24126, the Phantom of New Guinea.
The first Phantom rescued the Falu from their ship. They shared the secret of their magic health elixir, and the Phantom vowed to protect the Falu from all Earthmen who might want to steal the elixir and to keep the Falu's location a secret.
You're the Phantom of New Guinea.
Your mom's the Phantom of New Guinea. I guess we're both on the record as being fans of the comic page as kids.
The Phantom.
Do you have any history with the Phantom?
Oh, I didn't
know this was going to be such a rich vein of Roderickiana.
I loved the Phantom.
This is going to be first an hour of you talking about your childhood with the Phantom, apparently.
No, but you know, there were always on the comic page a few soap operas, a few dramas, Mary Worth. Comics that you kind of, and then we're talking about in the old days, right? By the 80s, a lot of that stuff had been cycled out, by the 90s.
But very few daily adventure strips.
Right. But the Phantom was the kind of soap opera for boys.
We only had Spider-Man in my childhood paper, the Pacific Stars and Stripes.
We did not.
Our fighting men and women get Spider-Man, but not the Phantom.
Spooderman. We did not have Spider-Man in our comic pages, first in the Seattle Post-Intelligencer or the Seattle Times.
You had to watch Electric Company if you wanted daily Spider-Man.
The Electric Company! Da,
da, da. 50 years old this week as we record this, by the way.
And then in the Anchorage Daily News and the Anchorage Times, also no Spider-Man. But the Phantom did appear, and I followed the Phantom's adventures.
We all know that kids in the 70s loved the Phantom more than Spider-Man. If there's one thing I remember about popular culture, it was Phantom Mania.
Yeah, no, you had to get Spider-Man in the comic book form, but... But yeah, and you know, the Phantom was pretty self-serious. It wasn't a ton of, there wasn't even the humor that Batman is famous for. But it was kind of, you know, it was kind of a little bit like Tintin in the Congo sometimes.
Sure, he's in kind of a hazily defined tropical setting.
Right.
Getting up to kind of hazily defined adventures against smugglers and like a kind of bad guy you're not sure if they actually exist, gunrunners and whatnot.
Right. But if it wasn't for those meddling kids, they would have gotten away with it. Or in this case, the Phantom.
Yeah, he's the meddling kids.
But he was also in a head-to-toe body, you know, like Lycra bodysuit with a mask. Good tropical wear.
Did they have?
I can speak from experience.
You've tried that.
Oh yeah.
You've worn your Spider-Man suit into the jungles of Costa Rica.
Yeah, the first 4 years as an adult that I spent in Maui, the whole time I was wearing a Lycra bodysuit head to toe
and fighting crime.
The people of Hawaii still thank me.
Did you know that's the Phantom's great innovation is that he wore a skin tight bodysuit.
That was not a thing before the Phantom?
No,
apparently. The Phantom goes back, right? To the 30s or something?
Yeah, the Phantom was first published in 1936.
And he came from this legacy of pulp heroes doing, heroic work to dastardly evildoers in the shadows, like the Spider or the Shadow, for example.
Well, and he also had the Lone Ranger's mask. It's almost exactly the Lone Ranger's mask.
These are the two innovations of the Phantom. You've really honed in on what it is that makes the Phantom so so omnibus relevant. Nobody before him had a skin tight bodysuit.
Okay.
You know, they all had raincoats and floppy brimmed hats, I guess.
Right. Six guns.
And there were characters before him with masks, famously the Lone Ranger and Zorro, but I don't know if that's a visual thing. I think at this time in the mid 30s, those are both like pulp magazine article, short story and radio serials. Yeah.
Now wait a minute. Does the Phantom predate Superman?
He does.
What?
Yeah, for Superman, I think it's, 38 or 39?
Oh.
Action number one is a couple of years later. And it's clear that that's the lineage from these pulp heroes to these guys who are not skulking in the shadows, dropping crates on opium traders or whatever,
right?
But who are actually like wearing kind of skin-tight, brightly colored stuff. And in many cases, wearing masks, kind of these domino mask things or around the back of the head, blindfold type masks with eye holes and no pupils. The Phantom also has no pupils.
Oh. Oh, right,
just
of course.
Just like Summer Vacation.
Yeah, it's some kind of, what would it be made of? It's not sunglasses, it's not mirrors, it's just an opaque screen.
And there's still kind of an uncanny valley, no matter who plays Batman. You watch the trailer and you're like, there's something about this guy. Oh, right, he's wearing like black grease paint around his eyes.
Yeah.
Because the comic convention of these guys having eyeless masks just looks weird when you try to dramatize it.
Yeah, right. Batman doesn't have eyes in the original Batman comics?
Well, he has eyes, but he doesn't have like
pupils.
Irises and pupils.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, the black grease like paint white thing around Michael Keaton's eyes or whatever, it was always very off-putting to me.
Well, also it's impossible because you see him just pull on the mask.
Right.
Where'd that circle of black grease paint come from, Michael Keaton? Like you told me the truth in Mr. Mom, maybe, and the Dream Team, but what's going on now?
Maybe inside the mask, there's like, he just smears it with black grease paint every time.
There's these little windshield wipers where he puts it on and they go under his eye. So you read the Phantom's adventures every day.
Yeah. 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 As part of the comics. I mean, we've talked about before, but I read every comic I could get my hands on. My daughter has picked up the mantle. There's no comic that she won't read. And she even goes further than I did.
And reads Fritz the Cat.
No, I read Fritz the Cat. I read Hate. No, she reads The Silver Surfer and all those, super.
You didn't read all the trippy Stan Lee ones.
No, the Stan Lee ones were just the trippy ones were just too trippy for me. I was like,
I'm a good kid. I don't know what Dr. Strange is. Yeah, no. I don't know what he's smoking.
I mean, give me Sergeant Rock. Give me the Lost Platoon or whatever, but. No, I don't know that stuff.
Do you know where I was right before I came here? I got my COVID booster, and then across the street there's this weird old comic store in Burien that only has weird old comics.
Yeah, that guy is
weird.
You know
that place, right? Oh, he's a weirdo.
He's very weird.
But I
hear sexist.
I think probably worse than that. He had a long tirade about how he won't go in Safeway anymore because the homeless shoplift there, and he can't support a company that doesn't shoot the homeless on site.
Maybe
we shouldn't be identifying this guy so clearly on this podcast with a mass audience. But
when young women go into the store to find comic books, he's like, "What are you doing in here? Girls don't like comic books."
Oh man, that's the comic store owner of my youth.
I know,
but I thought it was gone.
No, it's the comic book store owner of The Simpsons, right? Or yeah. I think
those are all based on. Like every store I went into as a kid to look for some Spider-Man back issue I'd missed had one of those guys who looked and sounded exactly like,
what are you doing in here?
The Simpsons guy.
You don't love comics.
But I was in there because it's the, as we record, this is the end of October and we always give out candy, but we also just have a table with a bunch of old quarter comics, and kids will be like, oh wow, Batman, kids are so excited when they see crap old comics, even though these kids would never, they don't own a comic.
So my daughter got into my comic book collection.
And well, she already had a room of Archie's and Tintin.
She did, but I was not somebody that kept my comics pristine.
Sure.
They're just a big box full of every kind of comic, and a lot of them date back to the 60s, because even when I was a kid, I was getting other people's used comics, and I'd kept them, and I kept them pretty clean, and she just tore through those. They're just comic book pages everywhere in the house. I'm like, hey, that was a... that wasn't worth anything, but you know, it made it this far in life. And she literally consumed them.
In the future, you know, the listeners are probably very happy. The slug men are happy to hear about the scarcity that your daughter helped impose on their own collection of 20th century ephemera. It's like every time a copy of Cloak and Dagger from 1974 gets ripped up, their value goes up.
It's like when Pete Townsend broke so many 63 SGs in the course of his guitar smashing years that they became
more
incredibly scarce, because he just, everywhere he went, he was like, one more 63 SG, break it, you know, SG Junior or whatever, broke it on stage. And now that, you know, find one.
One man campaign. Yeah. So then there is hope for somebody who just wants to go around the country smashing Mulan collectible plates in hopes that someday. That was Goldfinger's plan.
That's right. How did you know about my Mulan plate smashing?
Oh, your daughter hasn't found those yet.
No, she'll never find them. They're all in a dumpster.
So the Phantom is kind of the missing link between the pulps and the superheroes that you know, every actual living person remembers. But you and I remember the Phantom. I never read the newspaper strip, but he had a short-lived 1980s Saturday morning cartoon show.
I remember it, too.
King Feature Syndicate, I think, for decades has kind of labored under the misapprehension that the rising generation will love Mandrake the Magician or whatever, if they're just given the chance, you know?
Right. I think that by 1980, whatever, my Saturday morning cartoon days were over.
Sure. You were listening to Judas Priest.
By then, yeah. I had purchased the Led Zeppelin Coda vinyl.
And it's the same day you were like, should I watch Pound Puppies or, hey, what's this?
It kind of was. You know, Coda came out and it was for sale at Carr's Grocery on Northern Lights Boulevard in just a little, you know, they only had 17 vinyl records in the grocery store.
I just want to say for a second, the Northern Lights Boulevard sounds like a fake street name that you would invent if you had never been to Alaska.
It does. Northern Lights Boulevard and Benson are the two main east-west streets in Midtown, and Northern Lights goes west and Benson goes east.
This is the second time we've talked about Alaska street addresses, Anchorage street addresses on the show recently.
Well, anyway, that Cars had Coda, and I bought it. I was not aware that John Bonham had died. I didn't know anything about Led Zeppelin.
No one in Alaska knew yet.
But
the sled right. with the news was still months away.
But it was like one of those records. It was like $5.99 or something. And it wasn't a complete album, if I recall. Yeah. But I put it on, and that record's got some jams, although it wasn't well reviewed at the time. It was no Presence.
Well, while you were listening to the worst Led Zeppelin record, I was still watching Plastic Man on Como or whatever.
So do you remember the Phantom cartoon?
Yeah, so there was a cartoon called Defenders of the Earth, which sounds very grandiose, but really it's just who does King Feature Syndicate have the rights to? So it was like, what if the Phantom teams up with Mandrake the Magician and Flash Gordon? These characters that all Gen X kids loved.
Were they trying to, they were just trying to compete with Super Friends.
Exactly. They were trying to compete with actual IP that people liked.
Yeah.
So Marvel and DC superheroes. So these guys would, Mandrake the Magician's, what started out as his problematic native servant, Lothar, but is now kind of a nobler figure on this cartoon. And so I watched this and I was kind of, I could kind of tell, you know what, this is old timey stuff. Because there were also Tarzan and Lone Ranger.
That were part of this group?
I think they must have been sold to the same network in the same rights block or something. Because they were really trying to, they assumed that all kids just loved the IP of the 1940s.
Right. Johnny Weissmuller.
And these things were kind of animated. They all have Japanese, you know, directors and animation houses. So they actually had, you know, they looked better than
Speed Racer.
Yeah. The Littles or, you know, whatever the American show before it was. So they were action packed, and that's the first time I ever saw this purple clad jungle dweller, but I didn't understand the Phantom's mythos because he's teaming up with a sci-fi, adventurer and a, whatever Mandrake is.
An
old timey Satanist, basically. This is what kids want. Satanists, retro astronauts, and jungle opium fighters.
It's true that the Phantom was purple.
You know, did you ever see the Sunday strip?
Well, I did, but you know, the daily strip kind of plays a larger role in my mind. But yeah, in the Sunday strip, he's like plum colored or even purpler, depending on what the Anchorage Daily News had in their ink stores, right, that day.
That muddy color of overlapping blue and red and maybe some yellow dots. The the Marvel and DC convention then is now with the superheroes wear primary colors.
Right.
And, you know, if you see somebody in green and purple, it's because they're a little more
tangential
or something more nuanced about them. Like the Hulk is green and purple, for example, but so are the real bad guys. Dr. Doom and Lex Luthor used to wear green and purple. The Joker, obviously.
Yeah. If you think about green and purple, that's really, those are villain colors.
Look down right now, futurelings. If you're wearing secondary colors, that's, you're evil. That's right. How you know. You're some kind of sociopath and you have no idea.
Like most American men, I am wearing blue on blue.
Yeah, I'm wearing blue. Oh, look at my shirt. It's red and blue. It's red, white, and blue because I love America, but also Chex Mix.
It says Chex Mix. How cute.
It's actually red, yellow, and blue because it's got a little corn Chex.
Did you get that at Hot Topic or Target or something?
No.
I was at Target the other day and they were selling all these t-shirts from my childhood.
I've seen that.
That all look weathered.
They're pre-distressed. Yeah. It's like, wow, this is an old Star Wars poster. Wait, no, it's not. People just, they put dots on the edges. No, this I actually got sent to me by Ralston Purina because of my deep love for Chex Mix.
Nice.
So I'm a Kentucky Colonel, but of party mix.
You said something on Twitter and they were like, we love you, Ken Jennings. Here's a free t-shirt.
Yes.
Did they send you Chex Mix?
They did. They sent me one of every kind of Chex Mix, including some I'd never seen.
Wow.
I don't think I dreamed this.
Yeah.
It was really like marshmallow white chocolate Chex Mix. And I'm like, that sounds terrible, but I've never seen this. And it was some color that doesn't exist. And when I opened it, it smelled like my grandparents' house as a kid.
Hello.
It was a weird,
through a door. Did they have curry flavored Chex Mix? And
no, they didn't have like the Japanese, like that's what you would want, right?
Yeah.
Matcha and curry Chex Mix. And,
right.
No, it was all
wasabi Chex Mix.
It was all kind of regional. It was like, now I have the South Carolina only Chex Mixes. This is exciting. The, what was I even talking about?
Who knows?
Oh yeah. Primary colors.
Yeah.
The Phantom's purple is what I'm saying.
Yes. Purple and green. Oh no, he's got no green. He's just purple.
And the other way I know about the Phantom, speaking of trying to make 40s IP catch on with kids, do you remember this weird time in the 90s when, the biggest hit movie ever was Tim Burton's Batman.
Yep.
And in all reasonability, that should have started the superhero movie boom. That's when everybody should have been like, all right, time to roll out Spider-Man and X-Men and let's get this party started.
How interesting.
It did not happen. It
didn't happen. Why, Ken?
For a decade, it did not happen.
No. What was the thing that actually sparked the superhero movie craze? Well, Iron Man?
No, I think it's like X-Men and Spider-Man, the first Sam Raimi Spider-Man coming out around 2000, right. And both of those were...
Oh, it was X-Men.
Pretty good. I mean, X-Men was the first superhero movie in like maybe 10 years. I'm going to get corrections about this because there's probably some Blade movie I'm forgetting.
Yeah.
But as far as like...
I heard the other day Blade was a vampire that could be out in the day.
That's correct.
Wow.
How have you lived your life not to... Alaska has not found out that Blade's a vampire that can be... Oh, you guys don't have day there.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't that. It was just that Blade came out during a period of my life when I was much more interested in finding cheap crank. on the street than I was in watching movies.
People tried to tell you about Blade and you assumed it was a street dog and were very, very interested.
How do I get a hold of Blade?
Gotta get some Blade. So you'd think the 90s would have just been a boom in superhero movies after those Batman movies made $100 bajillion.
Right.
But I think Marvel had already sold the rights to a lot of their heroes to just TV companies and TV networks and fly-by-night small film outfits, independent film outfits.
Yeah, isn't that weird that there was a time, well, I guess, yeah, there was most of our young lives, nobody thought of intellectual property quite in the same way, right? It was like the car designs of the 60s. You made a really cool-looking car, and then 2 years later, you had to make a completely new cool-looking car.
Disney was the only place. Like, I remember, you know, even back then, you'd go to, I mean, today, you'll go to Disneyland, and they'll play Who's Afraid of the Big Bad Wolf during the fireworks, and you're like, sweet, the biggest hit of 1933. Thank you. But they, you know, they've been very good at finding a way to keep that alive in each succeeding generation. There's still Davy Crockett canoes at Disneyland.
And yet not the Song of the South.
Weird. No, there's a big Song of the South ride. Weirdly, from the 80s. But you're right. Nobody else was really like, how do we, you know, longitudinally keep people interested in Captain America, which I'm sure is a meeting a week at Disney today.
Well, what they did is they had comic books where Captain America fought hippies.
That's true.
You know, Manson. They were always trying to fight Manson.
Check it out. Wonder Woman's got bell bottoms and a job. Did we just blow your mind? So the 90s, the time when these movies should have been coming out.
Only 90s kids will remember this.
90s kids will probably remember this. Instead, what they did is they kept putting out these movies of, I guess they were under the impression that what people liked about Batman was like, it was like a noir take on 30s, on like World War II era pulps.
Right.
So instead there was like a Dick Tracy movie that cost more than Batman, and a Rocketeer movie, and the Shadow movie with Alec Baldwin.
Weird. Of course, they're all connected, aren't they? That Dick Tracy movie was terrible.
I kind of like the weird colors of it.
Look
down. If you're wearing yellow and blue, you might be Dick Tracy. Is your watch talking to you?
You're right. It did. Well, so is that because the people that were running those studios were the...
Maybe they were old.
Yeah. Were they all the 70-year-olds that...
Yeah, you know what the kids want?
We'll bring back Dick Tracy and Crime Fighter.
They did the research, and if Batman's big...
They went to the golf club and said, what do you want to see in movies?
And really, you ask any kid and they just would have been like, Spider-Man!
Yeah.
Or, Wonder Woman! But instead, we got... Alec Baldwin as the Shadow, and no less than Billy Zane as the Phantom. Did you ever see the Phantom movie?
I didn't.
It was just one of these generic kind of post Tim Burton Batman movies where he skulked in the shadows and, you know, had a...
Was it set in the 30s?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, the thing about the Phantom... Yeah, I think it was. All these were. You know, I think because the retro Art Deco... For some reason, people thought the Art Deco Gotham City was what people loved about Batman.
Well, it's interesting. We've talked on the show before about the Deco revival of the 80s.
Mm.
And maybe, you know, the Deco revival was part of that Miami Beach fascination, which all came from Pablo Escobar and the cocaine insanity.
For me, Don Johnson. But, you know, Pablo Escobar by way of Don Johnson.
But, you know, that it was like, why are we thinking about Miami now? Well, it's because of the kind of Cuban vibe that was down there in the late 70s. But
instead of Cuban sandwiches, we just got sports teams with teal logos.
Yeah, I know.
It was a terrible time.
But yeah, so Deco, but it's really interesting if you can actually draw a through line between, you know, from Pablo Escobar to Billy Zane, as Phantom.
Punching, gun runners.
It must just be the 50 years later thing, or the 40 years later thing, where every 40 years you look back for source material.
Parenthetically, why can I not think of who else Tintin fights? There's always opium traders and... gun runners. Who are the other generic baddies of that time?
Well,
they're just smugglers and Chinese junks.
The guys that wanted to invade the moon, right? The scientists who wanted to steal the moon.
But generally, these things have lower stakes. Like Dr. Doom really wants to blow up some kind of a posmium bomb in the middle of Manhattan and turn everyone into robots or something. But like in these things, they always have much less grandiose schemes. I mean, it's not quite like Superman where he's just going up against two guys that want to rob a bank, which doesn't seem fair.
Tintin was only an investigative journalist.
Yeah, there's
from Belgium.
So there's no mad scientists. Right. I mean, I'm not a Belgian reporter, but I assume you rarely go after a good mad scientist or a castle.
Or if there is a mad scientist, some law enforcement gets pulled in at a certain point and Tintin is no longer like spearheading the investigation.
That would be very funny if at the beginning of every Tintin book, Interpol is like, hey, why don't you stand down? I know you have your own apartment, but you look about 11.
We'll take it from here.
You
kid.
Collect model ships. We'll go after the cigars of the pharaohs.
Are the Nazis trying to steal the Ark of the Covenant?
Well, there's one Tintin book that actually has a slave trade. The Red Sea Sharks actually has a slave trade, but I assume they stayed out of that in the Phantom newspaper strip.
Yeah, no, I guess you're right. Didn't all the locals in the Phantom have bones through their noses? I mean, wasn't it?
Yeah, so there are some racial, there's some problematic racial depictions to talk about here. I mean, the Phantom newspaper strip dates back to a cartoonist named Lee Falk, born in 1911, like a St. Louis kid who headed to New York to try to make his name and, in order to try to get a job, you know, writing for the pulps or the comics or whatever, claimed he had been a world traveler, and I've seen Tibet and I've seen Tahiti, and really he just read National Geographic like every kid that age.
Right.
But it worked. Like his lies about his world travels got him a job. And so he creates this jungle crusader, the Phantom, for the comics syndicates. And
how did the Phantom, because the Phantom was a, was an Anglo.
Yeah. So the Phantom is the ghost who walks, and he is not the first Phantom. The Phantom is the 21st Phantom, I believe. Our Phantom is Kit Walker, but he's a direct descendant of Christopher Walker, who on a 1536 voyage for Drake, I don't know. Do the dates work out? You know, some English sailor is waylaid by pirates and washes ashore, as often happens in adventure fiction of this period, washes ashore on the heretofore unknown locale of Bengala, which has a very, you know, Indian subcontinent sounding name. It's got Bengal right there.
It's like Sentinelese.
Yeah, exactly.
The Sentinel Islands.
And early on, the setting is very much kind of a melange of a Malaysia, Sumatra, India kind of a vibe. Were you looking up Drake's dates?
I was, yeah.
So now you just bought tickets to Drake. Good job.
I did. I was like, whoa, all these different places on Drake Boulevard. In fact, my best friend in high school lived on Drake.
Are we back to Alaska streets?
Yeah, that's the third one. Yeah, so, you know, 1540s.
Oh, yeah, so perfect. Yeah. So he's from that era of the English circumnavigations of the globe. But our man washes ashore on Bengala. Falk's very interested in, you know, what he's read in the sensationalized press and fictions about, you know, Indian death cults and the thugs, the tuggies or whatever. And all this stuff was, I'm sure, really heightened for Western audiences, but he loved that kind of stuff. So that was where he originally set the Phantom. Indian subcontinent locale menaced by evil locals.
It's interesting that they had so little idea of genetics at the time that the 21st Phantom of Bengala could still be white after 21 Bengalese grandmothers.
Well, our Phantom is, his love interest is one Diana Palmer, a former nurse, Olympic diver turned United Nations Health Council bigwig.
Right.
So maybe circumstances have arranged for a beautiful white lass to wash ashore on the shores of Bengala every 30 years
since the 16th
century to maintain the Phantom's pearly whiteness. Cause this is really a prototypical kind of white savior narrative where, you know, even if there's not slavering, villains of color, there's the local pygmy tribe that rescues him, the Bandar.
Right.
And of course, they think that he's the same immortal Phantom who washed ashore hundreds of years ago.
And they keep finding damsels in distress washed on the beach and bringing them
hey, look
to
what
the Phantom.
Found. You like these blonde ladies, right? Or at least you did 30 years ago. The other one's getting kind of old, but you're not. So even if the depictions are not negative of his native friends, yeah, it's very much a... And the locale kind of moves over the years. Bengala by the 60s is pretty firmly an African nation.
Whoa!
So it's even more like you know, these people of the Dark Continent,
right?
More so than a quasi Asian setting.
Is it a thing where Sri Lanka became Ceylon and then it soon became Madagascar?
I almost think it was a time when white newspaper comic readers didn't care if this was India or Africa. Like, oh yeah, one of them places.
One of the places that hangs down from Russia.
Yeah. Or to them, one of the places where the skin color is different, right. Probably is more the overriding
thing. It's a dewlap of Asia.
The dewlaps of Asia. You think Africa is a dewlap of Asia?
I mean, if you don't know your maps very well.
The Phantom lives in Skull Cave in the deep jungle woods of Bengala. It looks like a skull.
Yeah, it does.
Must have been pretty sweet for the first guy to be like, I'm going to live there. Coda by Led Zeppelin's going to come out soon. This rules.
I wonder if it influenced the mask in the first place. Wow, I live in Skull Cave. I ought to
Dress
it up a little bit here.
Well, I don't know what the story is like. Do the natives give him a lycra, a purple jumpsuit in 1536?
He makes it out of banana leaves, I bet, for 400 years.
Bengala must have some kind of stretchy purple plant that he's leveraging for this.
You're a stretchy purple plant.
Your mom's a stretchy purple plant. Your mom was a stretchy purple plant when she had you. The other thing the Phantom has, and I remember this from the Billy Zane movies, he's got two rings. He's got the good mark on one hand and the evil mark.
Oh, so he hits you with the evil mark, but if you're good, he hits you with the good mark?
Maybe he just kind of like gives you a noogie with it, like an affectionate, because he does have one for his buddies, you know, like his mountain wolf sidekick Devil, his stallion Hero, he's got a falcon, He's got Diana with the UN waiting for him in New York.
What, he punches a falcon and a horse and a dog?
I'm not saying he punches it, but maybe he just, like a signet ring, he's like, but with his enemies, no, you're right. He will literally make sure they catch the evil
mark. And then they have a little skull on their chin for the rest of their
lives. It's the mark of the Z, like Zorro. Yeah. There's some later lore in, according to the internet tells me there's some later lore in Phantom Comics where it's revealed that the ring of the evil mark actually comes from the Roman Emperor Nero. You know, a kind of a twisted guy who actually had it made from the nails that crucified Christ.
Damn.
I mean, that kind of stuff does not happen in apartment 3G or Blondie.
And I'm just trying to imagine the pygmies that found that washed up on a beach and were like, hey, Phantom, look what we found. Like, how did it get there?
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Nobody in the future, or indeed in the present, will remember this, but the Phantom became a massive...
90s kids will.
If you watch Defenders of the Earth and Billy Zane. No, I think all those 90s movies failed, actually. Like, surprisingly, the kids did not want to see Dick Tracy updated for the modern day with 58-year-old Warren Beatty as the lead. But in the 40s, man, they couldn't get enough of it. There were a series of novels and there were movie serials. You know, you'd go to see the Phantom fight crime before your Western started on Saturday afternoon. And this continued throughout as the 20th century wore on, Bengala got modernized and was now kind of a forward-looking African nation. I mean, not Wakanda, but with a democratic, democratically elected president.
Right.
Not a Mobutu style dictator, but a reformer who the Phantom has to protect because assassins want to kill President Mbenda or whatever it is.
Right, because he's the last great hope of Africa. Yes. President Mbenda.
Or back then he's the first great hope of Africa. I don't know how what years are
we talking about?
This is early 60s. I'm sure
it's early 60s it would have been. Yeah.
But by this time he's fighting off communists, right? That's probably who the Phantom is leaving the evil mark on.
Right. It's communists.
Maybe they don't say it, but it's, you know, overseas saboteurs. Oh, that's it. That's it.
Overseas saboteurs.
Saboteurs. That's the kind of thing that these pulp guys are always
all
head up about.
I'm still upset about saboteurs.
I mean,
they're blowing up railway bridges.
Well, I mean, if I have an air conditioner, I don't want a saboteur. If I own a grill, I don't want a saboteur.
Nope.
And the Phantom becomes big worldwide. Like, to this day, there's a hit, there's a successful magazine in Sweden called Fantomen, which is kind of there, much as they, Scrooge McDuck continues to have a mix of reprinted and local Swedish adventures in the pages of a hit monthly. I guess the Phantom also has that status in Scandinavia.
So worldwide, by worldwide, do you often just mean Scandinavia or is the Phantom?
Yeah, what do you mean? No, this is going to be, as we'll see, this is truly a global story. There's an Umberto Eco novel called The Queen, what's this book called? The Queen, Mysterious Flame of Queen Lawana, which is kind of about his, even though he's the greatest, you know, intellectual of his day, he's writing books about his love, his childhood love for the pulps.
Yeah, it's just like George Will in baseball.
Basically, yeah. That's in Europe, you don't have baseball.
Right.
Some of these guys are into soccer, but that seems a bit hooligan-y. So instead, they get really weirdly into Donald Duck.
I'm hoping that writing about dumb things from your childhood actually can make your reputation as an intellectual, because I haven't written any great treatises on philosophy or psychology yet. But I am hoping to start writing books about...
Time for your book about Star Wars and Coda.
Yeah.
That could happen. I mean, that's what the people want today.
These days? Right. Who are the great intellectuals?
So Eco loved the Phantom and basically, you know, built a novel around his love for the Phantom. In Turkey, when it was miscolored in the paper or in the comics, so the...
He was orange?
He's red. Wow. So the Phantom is still to this day called the Red Mask in Turkey because they couldn't afford purple after the Ottoman Empire collapsed or something.
They lost the blue, yeah.
Yeah, where'd it go? But most interestingly, the Phantom is a big part of the culture of Papua New Guinea, a place that has never been on the omnibus before, to my knowledge, but lies just to the north of Australia.
and feels very much like the location of the original Phantom.
Bingo. Well, nobody can hear this, but I am pointing at you with the business end of a ballpoint
pen.
You
excitedly pointed at me.
That's exactly right. The Phantom was, came to New Guinea.
Is he a part of a cargo cult?
Kind of.
Whoa.
This is kind of a Prince Philip movement sequel, now that I think about it.
Yeah.
Except that unlike Prince Philip, he's real. No, sorry. Unlike Prince Philip, he's a fictional character. In World War II, the American servicemen fighting to liberate, were in New Guinea, trying to liberate the island from the Japanese. And in fact, Lee Falk was called upon to produce propaganda material specifically about, the liberation of, the Phantom's tropical milieu from evil Japateurs or whatever awful slur they would have used.
Oh, of course. All that stuff, there's always a phase of it.
Of Bugs Bunny or Superman.
Where they're fighting the Japanese.
Exactly.
Or the Nazis.
So Lee Falk had this, was working on this propaganda stuff that was actually about the liberation of New Guinea. And that kind of planted
New Guinea.
Right. Well, the whole island of New Guinea, it's half Papua New Guinea and half an Indonesian province called Irian and Java, but
called the Dominican Republic.
Right. The other side it's the Dominican Republic of Australasia, basically. So that kind of planted the seed for a love of the Phantom such that it was later reprinted for the rest of the 20th century there, both in English and the newspaper strip would be in English or in the local Creole, Talk Piscine. I don't know if I'm saying that right.
Yeah.
Probably.
Talked about Talk Piscine in the Omnibus before.
Is this going to be an entry?
No, it's one. Oh, maybe it will. It's one of those things that we've been talking about this a lot lately. Like we do the whole point of doing Omnibus was that it was a place for us to put all of our deep dives, but I keep doing deep dives and maybe not putting them in the Omnibus. And so I'm texting you in the middle of the night, like, have we talked about Talk Piscine?
What's up with Talk Piscine?
Or was that just a thing I was yelling at somebody about in a bar?
And as you point out, it's easy to see why the next two or three generations of Papua New Guineans, I don't know what the demonym is. Are they Papuans or are they New Guineans?
Papua New Guineans.
I mean, it wouldn't kill me to get this right.
They might be just Guineans.
The indigenous people are often called Papuans. So maybe you should not be calling all of the citizens Papuans.
Who, me?
Maybe one should.
So the indigenous people are called Papuans?
You just say Papua New Guineans. So these generations of Papua New Guinean kids, whether they spoke English or the New Guinean Creole, would read his adventures in the paper, and there weren't that many strips that made it over.
These were all just rehashed strips. They weren't still making them there?
I think they got a mix of old and new. Like they weren't just showing the 40s strips over and over, but maybe it was the kind of thing where they're always 15 years behind or something. And as you point out, this is a guy who has tropical jungle adventures, unlike all the other superheroes that live in a city, which looks nothing like where you're from. If you're a Papua New Guinean kid, this guy hangs out in a
jungle,
a weird pan Indian Ocean locale that kind of looks like your place. Maybe you don't have Skull Cave, but you wish you did.
Yeah.
And
actually, a lot of those islands do have skull caves.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, it's a feature.
I know King Kong does.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
See, 2 out of 2 islands surveyed. And crucially, he's friends with the natives. I mean, now this is one of the things that doesn't age well about the strip because it's got this kind of condescending attitude toward the locals. But if you're a kid growing up there's like people of color in this strip.
Right.
Like
who are heroic. Who are friendly.
Exactly. Yeah. Here's a superhero that would hang out with you, a Melanesian kid, which you're not going to get from a Superman movie or a James Bond movie.
Was this part of a colonial project that was trying to encourage Papuan kids, if they found a blonde woman on the beach, they should bring her to the nearest police station.
Yeah, the CIA was absolutely planting this in local papers to just a bulwark against the domino theory. As goes Papua New Guinea, so goes Asia, I guess.
That's right.
The
original domino.
But the interesting thing about the Papua New Guinea love affair with the Phantom kind of begins in the 80s and 90s when there starts to be tribal violence in the Western highlands. The different little Melanesian tribes up in the mountains they're not Sentinelese remote, but they're pretty remote. And they start getting into, there have long been arguments over women or over land or over accusations of theft. And the traditional means of battle there is very shield heavy. The warriors carry a big shield.
Oh, right.
I'm sure originally out of some kind of tough wood, but more recently out of surplus sheet metal or something.
Right. One more thing to make 50-gallon drums into.
Right. It's as tall as you. Originally it would have kind of in ochre paints, local pigments, it would have nature designs, butterflies and whatnot. It was not just in a lot of ways, this is ritualized combat. So it's also a symbol of protection for the warrior himself, but also for his family, for his community, for the whole village, for the whole tribe. So these things had kind of a talismanic, like a cargo cult, sacred thing,
right?
Relic. There's got to be a better
talisman,
like a cargo cult relic. It would have
icon.
Yeah, it would have kind of iconic import
idol
to the village. Yeah, I don't know if they're worshipped, but yeah. And in particular, the warriors of the Wagi tribe, they want strong protective emblems on their shields, and at some point, they switch from, butterflies and whatever their flowers, whatever their kind of traditional iconography is.
Nothing protects a warrior like flowers.
What if instead of flowers, John, it was a purple, buff, body-suited jungle dweller?
Wow.
I mean, that would be a pretty good thing to put on a shield, right?
Right. If I were coming through the jungle attacking a neighboring tribe and all of a sudden life-size shields covered with the phantom all appeared around me as though I were being attacked by 50 phantoms?
It appears as if this was all, I don't know if this is all the work or if this is just one largely influential artist, but there was one guy named Kaipel Ka who kind of lived in a remote part of Papua New Guinea who had a sign painting business. He had, he got a roadside sign, which is the hood piece of a Toyota Stout, kind of a mini Hilux, which he's painted with, his contact details and his sign painting business. He hung out his shingle. And if you open a store to sell Fanta or whatever up there, this is the guy that would paint all your sign. Exactly. This is not,
Fanta, not Phantom.
No, that's not product placement at all. And he's really good. Like I was watching a video about this guy's work and he can just paint anything. Like, eventually he gets so big that he Western collectors and galleries, kind of in the manner of the Afghan battle rugs that have been on the omnibus before, Western galleries and museums and collectors start to hear about this kind of bizarre jungle iconography, and there's a big market in these now. So, he'll paint shields with the Phantom or with Coca-Cola iconography. Often when these tribes made peace, they would share a Coke. And
what?
So,
come on, are you tweeting at Coke too, trying to get a free T-shirt?
Coke's not going to give me a free T-shirt. Everybody knows what Coke is.
So the tribes would make peace, and they would come together.
I've recently become aware of, like, if you had a childhood in West Africa or something, like what an annual treat, like a grape Fanta or a bottle of Coke would have been,
Right.
Like you would save that for weeks if you got a Coke on Christmas.
It's like the first Big Mac that arrived in Arad, Romania.
That's exactly what it is. It's been designed by foreign colonizers to just overwhelm your senses with salt and fat. And Coke and Fanta are the same way. Like you will, this is your month's supply of sugar in one fizzy bottle.
Oh, it'll blow your mind.
It's going to have a mouthfeel you've never had before in your village.
And the syrup and the,
All the stuff that's in every Coke commercial about, wow, what an experience. Like that's actually true. If you live in Ghana and get one of these a year.
I mean, it's kind of true for me. When was the last time you had a Fanta?
Oh, man.
It's still pretty exciting.
I look forward to my afternoon Diet Coke much.
I know you do.
An unhealthy amount.
The futurelings may not know this, but we here at the bunker keep a half rack of Diet Dr. Pepper for Ken. We've only recently started refrigerating them. They used to be...
It's pretty fancy now.
Warm, and now they're crispy cold. Man.
I can taste it already, and this is only the first show we're doing today.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so it looks like pop art, this amazing stuff this guy's producing. Because he's got, these, two natives wearing ceremonial headdresses clinking Coke together, and it'll have the Coke logo, and it will say, the Peacemaker or something. And you can see why any Soho gallery worth its salt.
No, I want that in my downtown loft.
I know, right? And the, but the, it was legit. The tribes were legitimately going to war and then later negotiating peace and hanging in their sacred huts. Shield, big 5 foot tall shields with the Phantom painted on them in some crime busting pose and an exciting biff, bam, pow,
Lichtenstein.
It totally looks like a Lichtenstein, except it's coming from Kaipel Kaz stand. He sadly passed away in, of cancer in 2008, which kind of, I think, ended the business of the Phantom's kind of informal representation of the of rural Papua New Guinea.
But only made those shields worth more money.
Exactly. This is like collectors getting excited when every time your daughter rips up some Marvel Tales reprint of a Stanley Spider-Man comic. Mm-hmm. But I just love stories like this of some little bit of Western, maybe it's awful colonialism, but it seems a pretty benign kind of some bizarre bit of Western detritus catching on in some totally unexpected part of the world. Maybe it's not colonialism because it goes the other way too. You know, Jerry Lewis catching on in France in a more highbrow way than it does here.
Uh-huh.
Or, aren't there musical examples of this? Like, what's the quintessential music industry example of the one song that's suddenly everybody in Japan or Madagascar is singing? That's a thing, right?
The opposite way is Gangnam Style. The first time that that a tune from Asia really blew the West apart.
I wonder if over there that was like, I wonder if they were like, boy, what a, of all the great K-pop or all the great culture of Korea, that's the weirdest thing to take over.
I wonder.
Is this one song, or if they were like, of course, Gangnam Style, that's the best we have to offer.
I'm trying to,
quintessential Korea.
Trying to think of bands that, I mean, my experience in touring in France and what I understand about Japan is that they do pick often random bands to turn into like the example of a great American band. Like the bands that the French think are the coolest American pop bands are not bands that you would think are the cool ones.
But the French don't know. Or maybe they prefer that it's like kind of under the radar.
It's a Jerry Lewis thing, I think. They're just like, oh, this is a incredible.
But the Jerry Lewis thing is that this speaks to the French soul in a way that it never could to you, the American, right? Like, isn't there something of that?
Well, yeah, and I think that may be true of their rock and roll, too. Like, oh, you could do not. You do not appreciate what you are making.
Can I just end with my favorite example of this phenomenon?
Our apologies to the French futurelings who probably speak like that, actually.
The French will not survive.
Their accents evolved.
The French will not survive. I mean, it doesn't matter if you surrender to a meteor or not.
But you're kind of like a Pepe Le Pew.
Yeah, I don't know what I'm doing there. You're doing the Monty Python guy.
Yeah,
right?
I spit in your general direction. I'm not doing a good job of it. Sometimes I'm pretty good.
Do you think it's less or more offensive that your offensive accent is bad? Does that double back and make it okay?
I feel like there are times when my John Cleese derived foreign accents are really on point, and sometimes I'm doing a poor job. It's more like I'm doing Bob Odenkirk's foreign accents, which are universally terrible.
I just got the COVID booster today, and I feel like it's making my foreign accents better.
Oh, well, let's let you handle that.
That's what Bill Gates is doing to me. My favorite example of this phenomenon happened in 2008. Do you remember, of course you don't, the early 90s cheapo Canadian international co-production television hour called Tropical Heat?
No.
No. This was a...
You're absolutely right that there is no way I would know.
I've actually seen this because my family was living in Singapore in the early 90s. And when I would go home, it's exactly the kind of weird thing that would show on an English language station in a kind of a random part of the world. This show, it was some cheapo post-Miami Vice, mm-hmm, kind of a roguish Canadian guy. I don't know if he was supposed to be Canadian, but
a roguish Canadian guy. Talk about an oxymoron.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know how convincing Canadian actor Rob Stewart was as roguish tropical adventurer Nick Slaughter. But he was always getting into trouble in beautiful locales, which were basically, the thing was shot wherever they could get tax breaks. Like it was in Mexico one season, then it was in Israel the next season, then it was in like Mauritius or something. Like basically wherever they could shoot for nothing and hire crew for nothing. Here, I think in the US it actually did air like late at night in like CBS had some crime time after prime time block where they would air a rotating array of these just awful, cheesy post-Miami Vice shows. And I think this show knew it was kind of cheesy. You know, it was kind of a wisecracking
guy. Nick Slaughter. It's right in the
he probably has a cockatoo and a, you know, there's a different beautiful woman in every show, but I think they know their Baywatch basically.
Yeah.
And it's for an international audience.
Oh, that's a perfect example of what you were saying before. Yeah,
exactly,
Baywatch.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or in the 90s, mid 90s in Europe, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. I mean, I know that was a hit show here too.
Yeah.
But you could not go to Europe in the 90s without people asking you if you knew Will Smith and Carlton and how they were doing and do they live in your neighborhood. And
interesting that I was in Europe quite a bit in the 90s and no one ever asked me if I knew Will Smith. I did get asked if I knew Bill Clinton.
I don't think you give off the vibe. See, you give off a different vibe.
Sure, that's right. I look like a cop.
You're like, I'm hanging out with Bill Clinton. And people look at me, a man of the people, and they're like, hey, what's
Yeah, I'm going to live with my auntie in Washington, D.C.
Ken looks like he might be from West Philadelphia, right? Right? Unbeknownst to anybody who made Tropical Heat, the show is becoming a huge hit in Serbia in the 1990s.
Okay.
I think Serbia was under UN embargo, so it was a pretty bleak time there.
Right.
And maybe that limited their access to Western media, but they could get this weird Canadian-Israeli co-production or whatever it was. Something about the, you know, the lush tropical setting appealed to
Serbs.
Bleak, war-torn Serbs. I mean, not bleak. People in bleak, war-torn Serbia. Right. I'm not going to say the people are bleak.
No, there are some bleak people in Serbia, but not all Serbs are bleak.
In particular, they loved Rob Stewart's character of Nick Slaughter with his, you know, roguish grin and his devil-may-care quip for any situation.
If you think back to the Bosnian War, the Serbs really did think of themselves as roguish, quipping Canadians.
Well, here's the thing. I hope this is not revisionist history. Apparently, he became a symbol of the youth movement, like the anti-Milosevic resistance to the nationalistic government and in particular the war in Bosnia.
Whoa.
So hopefully Nick Slaughter is on the right side of history because young people adopt him as kind of a symbol, and Nick Slaughter for president graffiti starts appearing in the streets of Belgrade.
Whoa, did young Serbians paint him on their shield?
It's the equivalent of the Phantom Shields. Yeah.
Whoa.
And these people literally, like, he was an icon to them. The same way, you know, hippies would have put Frodo Lives or Clapton Is God on a wall. These people were all about Nick Slaughter and his tropical cabana or boat rental agency or whatever the hell Nick Slaughter owns.
It feels very familiar to me, as though in recent times in America, there's been a political movement that has co-opted some kind of
Pepe the Frog.
Yeah. Oh, right. That's right.
He's our roguish, grinning Canadian amphibian overlord.
Pepe the Frog.
I think that happens pretty often
now. Feels good, man.
The Babadook is now a queer icon for reasons I don't fully understand.
It's because of that one meme of the girl that dressed as the Babadook that went to the Halloween party and no one else was.
So it's not the Babadook, it's an outsider dressed as the Babadook?
I think it's just that one girl that had that terrible picture where she was like, I'm at this party, and no one else wore a costume.
It turns out it's more of a grown-ups drinking wine vibe.
I'm such a good meme. It makes me laugh even now.
But you know who
only 2000s you know kids will get this.
You know who had not heard about the Nick Slaughter revival of Serbia?
Is Nick Slaughter?
Nick Slaughter. Actor Rob Stewart, nor indeed any of the makers of the TV show Tropical Heat, which had, you know.
You're kidding.
Folded long ago. And Nick Slaughter's doing community theater in Sudbury, Ontario.
He's the Prince Philip of Serbia.
He is alarmed to find himself the Prince Philip of Serbia. And I think he looks up something else related to his character name on Facebook, trying to see if there's any fan groups, and is just stunned in 2008 that he has been, for over a decade, a symbol of the youth movement of Serbia.
He had no idea.
He had no idea for over a decade.
Yeah.
So,
oh my God.
What's the first thing you would do? Buy a plane ticket, right?
Of course. Right? Call your agent and be like, what have you been doing?
It's basically the end of Spinal Tap, where the band is broken up and then it's like, good news, lads, we're going to Japan.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what happens. He gets on a plane and flies to Serbia. I think he gets a documentary crew to be like, this is going to be fun. I don't know if the documentary ever came out, but you know, there are just thousands at the airport to greet him, and wherever he goes,
wow.
It's, you know, people are reaching out their hands so that he can heal their afflictions, you know, like.
Do you think there's a Ken Jennings cult like boiling somewhere right now? Probably in Ontario, frankly.
That's the thing. Like Jeopardy doesn't play in that many markets, but it's so huge in Canada because of the.
Oh, right. The Alex Trebek connection.
The Alex Trebek connection and the fact that they're smarter than us. I mean, between those two things, Jeopardy is a disproportionately big
hit. Sure, the winners are long and they entertain themselves with trivia.
So I would love the idea of I just show up in Halifax or Brampton, Ontario, or someplace.
You need to stop besmirching Canadian baseball fans.
That's true. Okay, that's my resolution.
For 2022. Snark about the Blue Jays.
Canada, I love you. Even your awful drunken fans.
And that concludes The Phantom of New Guinea. Entry 928.IS0117. Certificate number 24126 in the omnibus. Futurelings, in the unlikely event that social media still exists in your era, please take the opportunity to go on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram and start a cult based around me. There's a lot of fuel to throw on the fire. I would love it so much if it turned out at some point in my late middle age.
If to find out that Honduras is super into you?
Yeah, or Moldova. They got nothing going on there, and I've raised their profile considerably by including them so many times in the omnibus.
I feel like it never works if we try. If we keep trying to mention how cool Moldova is, like all this Phantom stuff just happened unaware in the shadows. Same with Mayor Nick Slaughter.
Right. Well, but you know, the Phantom stuff happened because a jungle island environment was in the background, and out in the background of our show is the multi-tentacled sentient moss of the future.
They will love that we mention them. Like, they're going to watch other 21st century entertainment, and they're going to be like, why do Rachel and Ross never talk about algae people?
It's true. The cargo cults about us are going to be 1,000 years in the future.
That's okay.
Yeah, that's fine. Hi, everyone.
And definitely search for your social media exists. Search for your own name. Like, make sure you're not a hit in Namibia and just have been omitting all that sweet Namibia revenue.
Future Mibia.
For years.
That's right. And you can search for us to learn more about us in the past, that we were real people and not just your godheads, at Ken Jennings, at John Roderick. You can email us at theomnibusproject@gmail.com. You can ask for more information about our personal lives among the slightly hyped up super fans over on the Futurelings, wherever the internet is available.
Facebook or Reddit or Discord.
You can support our show by contributing monetarily at patreon.com/omnibusproject.
This is important because Moldova is not stepping up so far.
If you've been listening to the show for a long time and you love these outros, even though our I've heard recently that our outro music plays over the entire outro.
I believe that's true.
And that some people find it grating. If that's true, write to Ken at theomnibusproject@gmail.com, and we'll take a poll.
We should have a Patreon tier where you get a version of the show with no grating music, guaranteed.
But if you've listened all these years and every time we say patreon.com/omnibusproject, you go, I should probably do that one of these days. Make today the day.
You know what today is almost certainly? One of these days.
It is.
If you look at a calendar, it has to be.
Think about these days. They've been stacking up until now. Make today the day. Take the SE off of your letter sweater and throw it in the garbage. And you can mail us real darn things at P.O. Box 55744, Shoreline, Washington, 98155.
Listeners, from our vantage point here in your distant past, we have no idea how long our civilization survived before we all just moved back into the rainforest and began hitting each other with shields with Bart Simpson's face on them. We hope and pray that the catastrophe we fear may never come, but if the worst comes soon, this recording, like all our recordings, may be our final. But if Providence allows, we hope to be back with you soon for another entry in the Omnibus.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.